Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network, broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hello, this is Dana Cowan, and you're listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network. On today's show, we'll hear from some remarkable women whose grit and determination, intelligence, and sense of humor have made them big successes. I'll be speaking to a world-famous chef who bluffed her way into her first cooking job, a student who defends the practice of unpaid student internships, and a master sommelier who moved through the ranks of the restaurant business from server all the way to beverage director. She's now running one of this country's greatest wine programs. So my first guest is Barbara Lynch, the Boston chef and restaurateur. I've known Barbara since 1996, when she was named a Food & Wine Best New Chef. Back in 1996, Barbara was at a restaurant called Galleria Italiana. And to be honest, back then, that restaurant was more known for its two owners than because of the chef in the kitchen. But that team of mine at Food & Wine back in the day, they said, okay, yeah, she's a Southie, she's Irish, she's tough, but man, does she make incredible Italian food. So now, 20 years later, Barbara has her own empire, and she was just named one of Time Magazine's 100 most influential people. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, Dana. Thanks for having me.
I'm so happy to have you. I loved reading your memoir, Out of Line, Playing with Fire. What a perfect title for your book. I mean, I feel like you've been out of line since you stole pinoli nuts in the grocery store as a kid.
Right.
But it's all paid off, right? Like, your fearlessness, when I think about what you've been through and how you've just taken on every challenge that's come your way, I just think of you as this fearless lady. And I love this quote in your book where you say that you keep busting through doors, never stopping to worry about what lies on the other side. How did your, like, just figured out, you know, I'm going to prove it to you kind of mentality, like, start?
I just think, if I thought about it, Dana, I don't think I'd open the door, you know? That's like, I always say, oh, God, I did it just like the Barbara Lynch style. Like, I just say yes to it, and then I'm in it. And I'm like, what did I get myself into? Oh, God.
So tell us about that first experience when you said you knew how to cook, and you're on that boat, and you're like, oh, my God, how do I cook? What do I do now?
Oh, God, that was awful. Yeah, I lied. You know, I didn't even know how to say Zabayon sauce. I called it Zamponi. And he believed me. I was like, okay, I'm making quahog chowder. I'm telling this guy, like, everything he wants to hear. I'm telling him I'm a cook at the St. Patolph Club. Right now we're doing Dover sole tableside, sweetbreads under a bell. I had no, you know, and I'm making quahog chowder and Zamboni sauce. I'm thinking of, like, the thing that cleans the ice rink.
Oh. Right. So, and he didn't figure it out. Like, he didn't call you on it.
He didn't call me on it. He didn't call for resume checks. I'm like, he's like, okay, you're hired. And I'm like, oh, shit. Okay, library.
So, and that's how you did it.
At this restaurant called the Beef Tender, learn how to, like, cook meat, perhaps butcher meat, maybe, you know, like, work the line for the first time in a very, very busy steak restaurant.
And what made you think you could do it? And what made you want to do it?
What made me think I couldn't do it? You know, I mean, if I thought about it, I wouldn't do, you know, if I even thought If I even thought about what I was going to have to do, I wouldn't do it. But I didn't think about it, so yeah. I just did it.
You did it.
I think that's what I do. I've done that all my life, I guess.
Well, and it's all turned out really, really well.
Yeah.
I was wondering whether the fact that you always found a way to, you know, figure it out, take the next step, and be really successful has in some way made
Dana,
you...
Dana, when you came to my house for lunch, I'm like, what did I just do? Why did I say yes? You made me so nervous.
But it was delicious. I mean, I was embarrassed. I wanted more pasta. Pasta, pasta, pasta. Can I have some more, Barbara? And you're like, I think you've actually wiped me out. There's no more pasta. It was great. And meeting your family was also so special. But I was wondering whether the approach that you took, because you didn't have mentors. Your mentor was the library. Your mentor was the streets of Boston, just because that's where you learned to get it done, and you know that the honor code and all of that. Does that make you a better mentor and want to help other people succeed?
I feel like it makes me a better person. It makes me like an equal person. I'm not better than anyone else. I can play with a high gang, and I can play with the lowest of the low, and I can get along. And you know, which I have that opportunity too in the restaurant industry. I can be Relais and Chateau, and I can be as casual as I want.
Right.
It doesn't make me any better than anybody else. I've been, and also I always had that that frame of mind. Well, if I don't succeed, what do I have to lose? I didn't have anything in the beginning, and I know what suffering's like. And I know what having no food is like. I mean, sometimes we used to have imaginary sandwiches, you know, it's just kind of like, but I know what I know mostly is what it's like to be a kid in a housing project in the inner city where we don't get information that everybody, you know, that when new development happens in cities, they're like, oh, but we have, you know, this for inner city kids. But it's usually on the peripheral. It's not in the heart of the city and what we really need
right.
for kids to get up and out, for single parents who work three jobs. I know what it takes. And you know what, it just takes hope and dignity and a little more attention and a lot more information has to get to the heart of this the inner city. Hope is really the key.
And I guess you were sort of born with hope. You'd been a boisterous family with, there was six kids. And
yeah.
Of course, a lot of that sounds like a struggle. But I think there's always a lot of support and a lot of love with your Southie friends that you're so loyal to. They're still really, really great friends of yours.
Oh, my God, we're still friends. They haven't changed, you know. They're still... Oh, we laugh. I mean, they're just the same. I am still the same, but a little, well, I'm a little safer now. I don't take as many stupid risks. And I pay, you know, I have to pay taxes now because everything's legit. But
and I know that you paid back the Pignoli debt, you know, from back in the day, which...
Oh, yeah, my Catholic guilt. You know, I had to just do it.
Coming on strong. You grew up in the projects, and you grew up with imaginary sandwiches. And yet, when you started cooking, you taught yourself from books, and you ended up with a very beautiful, elegant, simple, strong cuisine that almost sounds like it's in contrast to the way that you brought up. Is the relationship between sort of the food and the energy of your childhood and then the food you decided to create and make your life's work?
Well, it's an in-between of what I knew I could handle and do right versus I couldn't strive too far because I didn't think I could handle it. You know, I've always had that goal in mind to be like Alain Ducasse or Joël Robuchon, but I wasn't really ready for that. That's going to take years. I mean, that's a master, right? Will I ever get there? I don't know. But I didn't want it to be too out there, too fancy. That's not me.
Right.
I'm not perfect. I don't plan on ever being perfect because then I stop learning. And I want to learn more. I'm still that curious little, you know, I'm curious. I don't want to be perfect, and I want to leave room to do what other purposes I feel like I have, I have a purpose to fulfill, you know?
And what do you think? What do you think
I want the person from the projects to be able to come in and eat dinner and not be intimidated. But I want it to be from my heart. I want it to taste great.
And your food does taste great. When I had the dinner that you prepared at Chef's Club just the other night as part of your book tour, I was reminded how spectacular your pasta is. Oh. It was a strospretti with braised rabbit and rosemary. And rabbit isn't necessarily the first thing I order on a menu. And after having that, I thought, oh my God, next time, this is the dish that I want. How did you choose that dish as one of your favorite dishes?
Oh my God, because of rabbit, rosemary, and green olives and strospretti is like heaven. I love that dish. I've made it forever, and it's kind of homey. It's kind of what I want to eat when I'm really, I want to feel good, you know.
Right.
And it's so hard to cook in other people's kitchen, and it's one of those dishes that actually comes out really great, and I don't have to worry too much. Believe it or not, I'm still nervous cooking, so I want to make sure everyone's happy.
I know that one of your great desires is to, you know, create the community and make the happiness around you. But what you were saying that, you know, you want to save room for your sense of purpose and living out like a more of a sense of purpose. Do you have a sense of what that is right now, or are you still discovering that, or
working on it? It's going to take a village, you know, like helping women, you know, who want to start their own business or change the restaurant formulas. It's just not going to be, we cannot keep it going this way. It's just not going to be feasible.
So what do you feel?
There's a lot. I mean, there's a lot going on that I want to do. You know, we're always fighting for better schools and better lunches in the public school systems. I think we're doing a great job, but I think it just has to go higher than this. We need more lobbyists in the White House that want to fight for children. Even though there's no money, like kids don't have money, so who's going to fight for them? That kind of thing. Shit has to happen.
And Barbara, I believe you are going to be the one to make it happen. Thank you. Thank you so much for being on the show. I can't wait to see you again and eat pasta someplace.
All right.
Together.
I'm sure I'll see you soon. Yeah. Thanks, Dana. Thanks for having me and have a great day.
Thanks.
All right, ciao. Bye.
Ciao. That was the amazing chef restaurateur, Barbara Lynch, who has so much love in every bite of her pasta. Next up, we have Sophia Hampton. Sophia Hampton is not a name that you probably know. Why? Because she is my intern here at Speaking Broadly. She is a student at NYU, and she also works in fantastic restaurants. She's working at Cosme and Atla. You probably know them because of their star chefs, Daniela Soto Innes and Enrique Olvera. So Sophia and I were talking the other day about Amanda Klute's comment on Speaking Broadly. Amanda is the editor-in-chief of Eater, and she made an impassioned speech is too strong a word, but impassioned speech about stagiaires and how stagiaires, which is unpaid interns in restaurants, should indeed be paid, and that there's some real problems with this practice. And Sophia had a different point of view. Sophia, tell me, what did you do your first stage? Because you have staged in restaurants before.
Yeah, so I did. Well, hi, Dana.
Hi.
So I did my first stage at a restaurant in Westport, Connecticut called The Whelp. It's a really excellent seafood-focused, creative cuisine-type restaurant, and it was the best one in our town. So I decided I wanted to start working in restaurants, and I just showed up one day and asked if I could help out. And that's how my first stage started. And I started there when I was 16, and I didn't leave until I went to college, so I was 19.
And so you think that being unpaid in the kitchen actually has some advantages. And I wanted you to just talk about what are those advantages?
Right. So I think that being an unpaid stage gives you the ability to grow in a way where if you're being paid, there's a set of expectations that you have to meet every single day. So all of your energy is focused on on meeting those expectations and, if possible, exceeding them. Whereas if you're a stage, you can just keep working and you're able to make mistakes and then learn from those mistakes without really the threat of, like, your main source of income being taken away.
And I think that, is it true that as a stage you had a more interesting, varied set of tasks to do?
Yeah, you're not really touching. I wasn't allowed really to touch the food until like 6 months in. And I was unloading deliveries, shelling peas. We would get these little snails called periwinkles in, and one of my jobs was to clean, well, for lack of a better word, the poop off of them.
And, what was your nickname? Go ahead. You can tell me what your nickname was.
My nickname was Shit Sack, because that was one of my jobs, was to clean the shit sack off of the tiny periwinkles, and it would take hours, and there wasn't really any way to do it really fast, because you had to keep the snail intact.
Oh, my goodness.
But, like, it was my job, and no one else in the kitchen was doing it, so it just seemed like I was going really slow, and I'm sure I could have gone faster had I really had experience, but it was the most tedious, most labor-intensive task for, like, a $12 piece of toast. And it was so, I look back on it, and I'm never going to forget that, and it was so valuable in terms of, like, work ethic and just doing something until it's finished. I'm so happy I had that opportunity.
That's such a great takeaway from that kind of task, because the opposite could also be true, where you feel like I did something that was, you know, benefited one piece of toast, but took a lot of my time. And then when you're actually paid and in the kitchen, the stakes are higher, right?
Yeah. They're way higher, but the reason that I look back on that and I think it was such a great experience was because I was hired as a line cook there eventually, and I don't think I've ever spoken to a stage who actually wanted to do that who didn't end up getting hired somewhere. So it's like it led to something. So and then I was paid, and then I had made a number of mistakes. I made so many mistakes, and I still made mistakes when I was paid. But it was like I had this history already built up with the restaurant and the kitchen, and I had made relationships with the chefs and stuff. So then it wasn't like I was just coming in hired off the street. It was like I had experience, and then I was a cook, and it was high pressured like any kitchen, but it was definitely, I don't know how it would have been for me had I just been hired as a cook and hadn't been a stage.
And what do you think of one of the major critiques of the unpaid restaurant stage or internship, which is that it creates a certain hiring inequality because only a certain kind of person can afford to not be paid, and then that shapes the labor that's in the kitchen. What do you think about that?
I thought that it's such a valid critique, and I don't have the answer, but I also think that everybody should work at least, I don't know, 2 months in the service industry, no matter who you are, because it'll just make everyone better people. I think it should be like a service requirement almost, because I don't know where. It's just restaurants are such a hard thing to try and restructure because there's such an established system. But I just know that the concept of staging and putting in your hours and paying your dues is so valuable to the workforce, and it gives people such this hardened experience that you're not going to get any other way if you're asking to be paid in that way. That I don't know I don't know what it would be like if you were paying them.
I think that, thank you so much. That's such an eloquent explanation of the power of staging and the power of working in the service industry. So thank you so much, Sophia, for this and for all of the work that you do with me on Speaking Broadly. I really appreciate it.
Of course. Thank you, Dana.
Thank you. We're going to take a quick commercial break here. And when we come back, my guest will be Joan Rodolph, who's the beverage director for McGuire Mormon Hospitality Group in Austin, Texas. We'll also be doing the first ever Speaking Broadly ticket giveaway for the Food Book Fair this weekend. So stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Welcome back. You are listening to Speaking Broadly on Heritage Radio Network, and this is your host, Dana Cowan. Joining me today from Austin, Texas, is Joan Rodill, the beverage director for McGuire Mormon Hospitality Group. That group owns some of Austin's best and most fun restaurants, including Lambert's and Jeffrey's, and a restaurant that is named after June herself, called June's All Day. Welcome, June.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
I'm so happy to have you, but I also want to know, did I butcher your last name?
No, it was perfect.
Oh, that's so good. So you have worked in so many incredible restaurants in Austin, from the Driscoll to Uchi with Tyson Cole to Key with Paul Key. You've risen steadily through the ranks, and your master sommelier, which is so impressive. I cannot believe that there are only 149 master sommeliers in all of America, and you are one of them. It's
crazy.
It's actually crazy on so many levels. But when I think about all of the things that you've accomplished, and there are so many, it feels to me like you're a really hard worker and a very determined person. All those hours of studying, all those hours of service. I'm curious, what drives you or what motivates you?
Oh, man. I think the fear of being bored and the fear of, like, not feeling fulfilled. So there's always something to be better at. There's always something to achieve. And I don't know. I honestly, sometimes I don't know exactly what it is I'm facing, but I just know that it feels good to be busy and to have even small senses of accomplishment every day. And then as you accomplish them, you're always like, I like, you know, traversing mountains and looking for the next one. So if I'm not at work, I feel very weird.
And so do you live your life by a checklist, like either mental or physical, that at the end of the day it's checked off and you know you've accomplished something? Is it that kind of thing?
It is. It is. I mean, mental and very, very physical. I write a checklist every day, and sadly, every day it's never completely done. So I turn the page of my notebook every day, and then it always has something already on it when I wake up. But I think that that just keeps me going, you know? I mean, sometimes there are moments where I feel like that checklist is in my throat, you know, it's just kind of just sitting there, and I feel the anxiety of things not having been done. But it also, you know, there's that fear of that blank page one day.
Right.
I don't know what that would mean.
That's so interesting, that because sometimes a blank page means that you get to write your own story, and sometimes a blank page means you're just stunned into doing nothing. I know that you were going to go to law school, but then you took a left turn into hospitality. How did you make that decision?
It was a pretty wide left turn that I just didn't even realize that I was making. I mean, I think a lot of times, you know, people do fall into the service industry whenever you're going into higher education. I had to do it to pay the bills, be able to kind of sustain life. And the flexibility of hours allowed me to just keep going, work full time and go to school full time. So I ended up really just liking it. And I think that it took all of those years and finally graduating and then also, you know, applying to law school and getting accepted to realize that I've just been doing the things that I actually enjoyed. But, you know, at the time it was in the aughts, like the early aughts into 2006 or so, where really it wasn't like a legitimate thing to say, I'm going to be in the hospitality industry, especially in Austin. Uh-huh. It was still very, very small and emerging. And I mean, I'm a pretty competitive and ambitious person, and it's hard to say, I really like waiting tables. But there's a sense of fulfillment in hospitality and like really showing people a really great time. And I had to grow up a little bit and realize who I was and be smart enough, maybe brave enough to admit to myself that, you know, I didn't need to go into some idealized, like, law firm. I would have been a horrible attorney. I probably would have been a good attorney, but I probably would have been way less happy.
Well, choosing happiness, I think, is always a good goal.
Yeah, I think so too.
So when you were a server, you learned, there's a lot of lessons that you learned, I feel, that you've carried with you through the profession as you've grown. Like, what were some of those foundational lessons that have stood you in such good stead?
I mean, you have to realize it's not about you. That's it. It's just, I think it's a really great lesson every day because, you know, it's very easy to make your life about you because you're there the whole time. and it's one of those things where, you know, when you are in the hospitality industry, when you're serving, it really is easy to get into the zone and realize, man, every single person on this planet is having their own narrative. And if you just take a moment to listen to them, you can really change someone's day. And that's a really, I think, great lesson that I still to this day forget to tell myself the moment I step out of a service or a busy, you know, restaurant. I just immediately kind of recede back into what's going on with myself. Right. And also, you never want to piss off the dishwasher. That's like number one.
I believe that at home too, because the dishwasher is my husband. So I never want to piss him off because I'm happy to cook, but not really happy to clean up so much. And I think the larger lesson, seriously, though, it is true, no matter what your work environment is, anytime you make it about you, if you're the leader, you lose the following of your team, right? And in the case mm-hmm. of hospitality, you lose the patience of your guest, or you lose sight of what you're trying to accomplish, which is to give them a really great, great time. I know that you worked with Paul Key. That was one of the groups you worked with. And Paul, whose restaurant Key was extremely well regarded, and he has food trucks, but he also has had enormous personal challenges with drugs and an arrest. And I'm wondering, from being inside that organization, and can you tell me about running his group and what that was like? That's not probably the right way to describe your job there. But.
Yeah. Oh, no, for sure. I mean, you know, I was the director of operations for the group, so there's a lot of different things. I think we opened, you know, the food trucks turned into brick and mortars, and those we opened two right away, even before Key finally opened. So we were just constantly on the go, like really erratic in terms of what we were doing. But I will say that the most amazing thing about working for that group is that somehow no matter how disorganized we were, the employees there were just extremely self-motivated. And it's really hard to find. I mean, and perhaps it's one of those things, like, you know, there's like those parental philosophies where, like, you know, no matter what you do, your child is going to turn out to be your child. Or there's, you know, the orchids where you have to say, like, okay, you have to nurture this child as much as possible. And I feel like we were in a field of daffodils that no matter what we threw at them, they were just, like, wonderful daffodils.
Wow.
And those guys are completely ambitious. And that's it. And I think it has to do with the persona and the aura and the intensity that Paul brought. Like, no matter what his personal problems were, the intensity that he brought when he was in the kitchen and when he was cooking was really, it turned into mythology, you know?
And so
gravitated towards them.
And do you think that the mythology is what made people so motivated to make that myth true? Or do you think it was that you guys hired a unique group of people with unique attributes? Like, how do you think you find that person who's so self-motivated and can stay sunny and be an upright daffodil instead of sort of, you know, a wilted fern?
I think that hiring is extremely, extremely important, and taking the time, you know, and it is the most difficult thing because if we're open breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and for our GM to have time to interview is amazing because she's just there 16 hours a day.
Wow.
But the importance of hiring the right person and to retain that right person, you have to be patient. And I learned that at Uchi, and I think that Paul learned that at Uchi as well. We kind of grew up in management there together.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, there were times when the owners would sit in for host interviews and dishwasher interviews, you know, and there was this myth that you had to interview at Uchi 7 times to get a job, and I'm sure that there are people that actually had interviews 7 times to get a job, even to be a host, but it was really about staff retention and really kind of taking people through the gauntlet and seeing if they really wanted to do this or if this was just a fluttering thing in their life. And it's a weird thing because, you know, the restaurant industry is booming and I feel like people want to hire great people, but sometimes you have to ask the right questions to see that someone can grow into that job. Because just like me, like everybody falls into this industry. You know, there's very few schools in Texas and in the nation that are catered to hospitality. And it's not something that you really kind of, you know, when you're in kindergarten, you don't say, like, I'm going to be a server.
So what do you think the most revealing question you can ask is when you're hiring someone?
I often ask things like, if I asked your former employer what they disliked most about you, what would they say?
And you have to hope that they don't turn it into like that sunny positive, you know, the negative that's really special.
Yeah, and I think what that, I mean, for me, what that shows is that someone really has taken the time to figure out who they are, or
mm-hmm.
is taking the time to figure out who they are and be aware of their faults. Because, you know, you always want to showcase yourself in your best light whenever you're interviewing. So everything is like super sunny and positive and amazing and I'm excited and I want this job and I'm the person for you. But you also like want a sense of realness and you want to know that this person has faults. So you can see what you can help them with as a manager, as a mentor in the future, you know?
Right. I think that it's great to get a leg up on, you know, what the challenge or opportunity to help someone grow would be instead of tripping into it 3 months later, like, oh, I didn't realize that you're actually, you know, afraid of numbers. Oops.
Yeah.
So you are definitely not afraid of studying because you took that Master Somm test three times, which frankly I've heard of people taking it so many more times and you succeeded, so that alone is exceptional. But were you discouraged at all by not passing that first time?
Oh my God, yes. Oh Lord, yes. It was crushing, but I knew that I wasn't ready. Like, I knew. And I think it was crushing because I knew going in that I had not given myself the time to pass the theory portion of the exam. So I passed tasting and the service, the practical portion,
mm-hmm.
the first time in. And so I knew what puzzle piece was missing because I knew that I didn't sacrifice enough time and effort for it. And it took two years to finally get that last piece of the puzzle. It was really strenuous.
How did you psych yourself into like taking it again and succeeding through it? Because I can imagine how defeating it is to, you know, not succeed and know that you could have done better.
Oh, man. I mean, so I quit my job. I left HE as the director of operations to be the beverage director for McGuire Mormon. I completely changed my job title because as I grew more into the industry, I realized that a smaller and smaller percentage of time was actually spent on a thing that I fell in love with, mm-hmm. which is beverages, wine. And it's a great thing. It's going to happen no matter what. And I think people need to realize that because just you're never going to do the thing that you love 100% of the time. That's why you realize that you love it because you can't have it all the time. And it was such a small part of my day that I just kind of started looking around and you know, very quietly talking to Larry McGuire, who is the CEO of our company, about possibly becoming his beverage director. And it was a really long process. It was difficult. It was because I'm definitely the type of person who's ambitious enough to think that I'm going to retire at the job that I presently am every time, no matter what job. This is a job for me forever. And so, I'm not a big crier, but I just remember just like getting really teared up whenever I finally made the decision to leave because I needed to refocus what I did on the day-to-day basis to be able to pass the exam because it was that important to me.
And did you feel once you passed the exam that it made you better at your day-to-day job, or was it a credential that you're proud to have, but it didn't change your life and your business?
A little bit of both, honestly. I think that it definitely made me better in my day-to-day job because there's the confidence behind the post-nominals, mm-hmm. right? And it's the confidence that there are many things that won't be questioned because you have the post-nominals. But I think that it's also important that you use that for yourself to know that you have to stay up on your shit because you have those, because people look up to you. You know, I have to study all the time. I have to definitely make sure that I'm still up to par on all of my knowledge whenever I'm training my staff because they expect me to. That's what those letters mean.
Right.
But as far as like what my job was, I think a lot of people think that once you get those letters, like something happens and you quit your job and you get this better job and you like, you know, get this crazy pay raise and you're going to buy a Mercedes and become a partner in a firm or whatever. And it's totally not it. I mean, definitely there are success stories like that, but you know, I really feel like my success story is that I got to find a position that I already wanted to do, post-nominals or not, master sommelier diploma or not. I just, you know, I got to be proud of something that I did and use that certification to make myself better in the position that I already am.
Right. So on the show, I ask people to read a quote or a passage that inspires them. Is there something that inspires you?
Yes, for sure. It's a passage from the famous commencement speech at Kenyon College by David Foster Wallace, called "This Is Water."
Okay.
And so my favorite part is, the really important kind of freedom involves attention and awareness and discipline and effort and being able truly to care about other people and to sacrifice for them over and over in a myriad petty little unsexy ways every day. That's real freedom. That's being educated and understanding how to think. The alternative is unconsciousness, the default setting, the rat race, the constant gnawing sense of having had and lost some infinite thing. The capital T truth is about life before death. That's it, man.
I feel like that should be the hospitality manifesto. That's that is.
It is. It's so great. He's one of my favorite writers. I love his train of thought. And it just makes you want to be a better person. But you also really know that it's really hard to.
Uh-huh.
Like, it's just about understanding that we are self-centered. We are who we are. So you have to really make the effort. And if you're not making the effort, then you're back to square one, which is not something that you know, you can't make the effort every day. But realizing when you are and when you aren't is kind of a big thing.
Well, and it's back to your theme here of self-awareness being so important. Let's talk about wine. Like, we've talked about a lot of business, but you love wine. First of all, I love that you created a wine zine for your wine list at June's All Day. That just shows your enthusiasm and humor and the joy that you bring. Tell me, what are your favorite wine regions right now?
Oh, right now, I mean, it's so hard to pin down, but just kind of all over the place. I really love Burgundy. It's my first wine region I ever went to in 2010, and have visited it four times since. So it's the hallmark, it's the icon, it's like the ungettable that changes your life. It's really expensive though, so you gotta get it while you can.
And is there like favorite accessible bottling? I mean, the thing about Burgundy is I feel like they're all inaccessible, they're all on allocation, the things that I would want. But for someone who wants a starter bottle of Burgundy, what do you recommend, or what producer?
I mean, I feel like just get the least expensive bottlings of certain producers that are high-end, because then it'll give you a great idea. It's really about the maker to me, not necessarily just Burgundy in general. So, I mean, right now, I think someone who's just on the cusp of everything is David Bois. He just became the winemaker for Domaine Rouleau, but he has his own label, Domaine de Croix.
Oh.
He used to make Camille Giroux. And he's like in his 30s and just, he's like young and vibrant. It's kind of like that, he's that new generation of Burgundian winemaker, and everything he touches is just so great. And he starts at like $20 a bottle and goes into,
oh my God, I'm so sold.
Many zeros. So everything that he makes is just quality driven. He's super meticulous. He's wonderful.
Wow. Okay. A less expected region. I know you're interested in South Africa, New Zealand.
Oh, my God. I love South Africa. Yeah. I mean, one of my favorite regions is the Swartland. It's really, really hot right now. Like, I mean, a lot of wine nerds are super into it. And I think it's because it's a little bit of the wild, wild west of South Africa. Like, it's got this country vibe to it. And you can get high-end and you can get affordable wines. Two of my favorites are Eben Sadi and Adi Badenhorst. They're like neighbors across the street from each other.
Uh-huh.
And they're just amazing. Adi's wines are super accessible. And the quality of wine that you get for the amount is amazing.
And what is the price point of South African wine? I always thought that it was a little expensive and a little bit hard to find.
Of which one?
I thought some of the South African wines that are exported to the U.S. or imported in the U.S. are a little on the expensive side and a little bit hard to find. Like, what type of price point are you looking at for those wines that you just mentioned?
So for Adi's wines, he's got a line called Secateurs, and you're looking at like $16 a bottle for a bottle of really delicious rosé.
Okay.
So it's really, really affordable. And then you can have the very allocated, nerdy, really breathtaking wines that Eben makes, and they're higher. they're in, some of them can be in the $200 range, but he makes so little of them.
Okay, so we have one high, one low choice. Always good. And give me one other location you're in love with right now.
Okay, I'm super in love with the Canary Islands, partly because I'm going there on my honeymoon.
Hey, congratulations. You're getting married in a couple of weeks, right?
Yeah, Memorial weekend, so I'm super excited.
That's great.
But no, those wines are so rad. And two producers that I love are Evinate and Suertes del Marques. They're just so great. And I never knew the quality level of those wines because they never left. So they're just starting to get exported into the United States, and they're super interesting, indigenous grapes, but, I mean, I think bottom line, they're just flat-out delicious.
How hard is it to get the people of Austin in your restaurants, or the tourists to try new wines? Easy, hard?
I'd say easier than you would expect, you know? And it's, again, about, like, reading people. But for the most part, you know, if you're in a very fun atmosphere, people want to have fun. And sometimes fun equals stepping out of your comfort zone. So really about kind of, like, holding your hand out for them and being their spotter.
Uh-huh. I love that.
You're just, like, allowing them to try to figure out new things.
And do you curate each list quite differently, or are there overlaps between all the lists you do? Do you have seven lists altogether?
We have seven lists altogether. There's a very, very little overlap. There's no overlap or lines by the glass ever.
Wow.
We really want each list to be autonomous and to speak to the concept, because we are concept-driven restaurants, and each restaurant is super, super unique. We are going to do one wine by the glass. It's our private label wine that we'll launch in the end of the summer to kind of brand the wine list together. And then that's it. Everything else is really what speaks to the location.
That must make your job even more fun. So
Yes.
I love to ask the women on the show, because I admire all of you, to nominate another woman to the Hall of Dames. Is there a woman either in the wine business or in the food world that you'd like to nominate to the Speaking Broadly Hall of Dames?
Oh, in the Hall of Dames, in the food world, my God. I mean, I just really, really love Jordan Salcido. She's the best.
I love Jordan. Are you nominating her for her Bellis wines or for Ramona? Tell me why Jordan.
I think just because she is so kind. She honestly, because she is this persona, right? You know, you see her everywhere. She's got a really great following. But she is such a nerd. I really love it. we hold up in Aspen in a room together for our Master Sommelier exam for almost 24 hours and started like just kind of reviewing and studying. And she's just so great. She personalizes everything with her touch. And I think she's pretty honest with herself, you know, and I love it. And I think that there's so few people that what you see is what you get. And her persona is just a very, like, lovely human being, and that is who she is. And she really truly has that many questions. Like, she asks so many questions whenever she's in the winemaker or when we're studying, that it's a true love of wine.
Well, that is a great way to conclude this conversation on the wine nerd and Jordan, because coming up next, we're going to give away two tickets to people who are magazine nerds in just 1 second. But first, I just want to thank you, June, and I can't wait to see you and go drink some wine all day with you.
Yeah, awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
Take care. And now I'm going to welcome Amanda Dell. The two of us are going to give away tickets to a Foodiotical's event this weekend in New York City. So I love giving away things. I've never given away anything on this show before, and frankly, I never win anything. Like, I've never, like, been that person who's won that random drawing. So I'm very happy to be the person controlling the random drawing and giving it away to somebody else. Amanda, tell me about the food book fair. What is it? And I love the name Foodiotical's, of course. Tell me what that is.
Definitely. Hi, Dana. Thanks so much for letting me pop on. We're so excited to tell everyone about Food Book Fair. Food Book Fair has been lovingly referred to as the Coachella of writing about eating. So it's kind of somewhere in between a festival and a conference. So we have some of the academic parts of a conference. We are doing an event called Food Book Fair School on Friday, where our participants can kind of take a deep dive and go into breakout sessions where they can really learn from industry leaders. And then we're also have kind of the fun festival part of our event, which is partnering with amazing chefs to do dinners and breakfasts inspired by their latest books or other media that we are loving right now and want to celebrate. So it, in some ways, it has that academic vibe of a conference, and in other ways, it has that, that fun of a festival. And I would say the biggest festival part is Foodiadicals. We are inspired by walk-around art book fairs at table, and so what we've done is given a chance to our favorite Foodiadicals, which is a portmanteau of foodie and periodicals. So what we consider independent food magazines. So this one isn't for the quote-unquote glossies. This is for your Cherry Bombs. This is for your Mouthfeel mags. This is for your Put an Egg on It. So all of the makers will have a table, and everyone will get to walk around, meet them, buy magazines, get other cool magazine swag. And so that's what we're giving away 2 tickets to for our Sunday Foodiadicals.
That's so great. Having come from the glossy world, I always admired the creativity and the just sort of the immediacy of some of that zine world. So tell me first, what is your favorite zine?
Oh, Dana, that would be like if I had children picking my favorite child.
well, you're stuck.
I'll give you some that I'm definitely.
Or how about this?
I'm looking forward to it. I'm gonna make it easy for you. I will say this: Cherry Bomb is going to reveal and have their brand new issue with their new cover woman. So I'll say I'm particularly excited to see who's gracing the cover of Cherry Bomb.
Okay, that's a good one. And what about a zine that no one's ever heard of? Like, what should we know about that we don't know about? Maybe that's an easier question to answer.
Definitely. Well, if you don't know about Put an Egg on It, that is definitely one of my favorites.
And why is that?
Well, I think it has such a great combination of recipes, of stories, of throwing dinner parties and taking photographs of that, and providing a really unique perspective and a kind of casual vibe to entertaining, but still one that's really fun. And also, I love it because of its size. It's definitely on the smaller side, which means it's really great for traveling, and you can always just stick it in your bag. So I love that.
That's great. So here's what we're going to do to give these tickets away. Take a picture. We're going to ask listeners to take a picture of their favorite. I think it's going to have to be just general food magazine, including zines, because maybe people aren't going to have a zine at home.
And then we love them all.
You love them all. Okay, good. And then to tag on Instagram, tag Food Book Fair and tag Speaking Broadly. And you and I can do a random drawing of all those people who've tagged us, and then we'll get in touch. How does that sound?
This sounds super fun.
Okay.
Always exciting to do things on the internet, and then maybe we'll get to meet in real life.
Exactly.
On Sunday.
What a good idea. So the giveaway is for Sunday, and tell a little bit more of the details of what they'll...
Yeah, you can, on Sunday, you can choose to join us at noon or 2 o'clock. We have 2 different entry times. Definitely, we can be flexible there based on your schedule. And also, the exciting thing about Sunday is that Stephen Satterfield is going to be there celebrating his new issue of Short Stack featuring Peanuts. And he also has a beautiful new cookbook coming out, Root to Leaf. And it's come through to see him. He's going to have some special peanuts that he brought all the way to New York. And you can congratulate him on winning a James Beard Award. So we're so excited to have him there on Sunday. So it's an extra bonus party.
That's great.
And then
we get
to see all of the magazines that will be there as well. We'll have drinks. We have Brooklyn Brewery beer. It's a fun party.
Okay.
With magazines.
That's great. Thank you so much, Amanda. And
oh, my gosh. Thank you.
That wraps up our show for today. Thank you, all you listeners of Speaking Broadly. You can find me, Dana Cowan, at FW Scout or Speaking Broadly on Instagram. Remember to post a picture of your favorite food periodical, tag me, tag at Food Book Fair, and we'll see if you can win tickets this Sunday. I want to thank my engineer, David Tadashore, who's awesome, and enjoy your week, and can't wait to be talking to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.